University of Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education. June Examination Session 2010. English as a Second Language. Extended Tier. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, center number, and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you're doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the test. Look at questions 1 to 6. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. You will hear each item twice. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. Where will the visitors go during the first part of their visit?
Listen, everyone. Your exchange partners are coming here to stay from the 12th to the 22nd of July. For the first 5 days, it'll still be term time, so your guests will have to come into school and join in our lessons. When the holidays begin on the 17th, we'll all meet each day for trips together. Any questions? Listen, everyone. Your exchange partners are coming here to stay from the 12th to the 22nd of July. For the first 5 days, it'll still be term time, so your guests will have to come into school and join in our lessons. When the holidays begin on the 17th, we'll all meet each day for trips together. Any questions?
Question 2. What might the friends put on the top of the cake? Give 2 details.
I found a recipe for a lovely celebration cake. It says it serves 8 people. Let's make it for our end of exams party on Wednesday.
Okay. Read me the ingredients so that I can write us out a shopping list.
A packet of flour, 4 eggs, vanilla sugar and some butter. We'll also need some chocolate to spread over the top of the cake. Or, if you prefer, we could use cream instead. I found a recipe for a lovely celebration cake. It says it serves 8 people. Let's make it for our end of exams party on Wednesday.
Okay. Read me the ingredients so that I can write us out a shopping list.
A packet of flour, 4 eggs, vanilla sugar and some butter. We'll also need some chocolate to spread over the top of the cake. Or, if you prefer, we could use cream instead.
Question 3. Where exactly is Tiana's accommodation for her overnight journey to be found?
I would like to buy a ticket for the Chennai to Mumbai overnight train, please.
Here you are. Carriage number 4. Your bed number is 48X.
I would like to buy a ticket for the Chennai to Mumbai overnight train, please.
Here you are. Carriage number 4. Your bed number is 48X.
Question 4. What is the reduction offered in the High Street sale?
Do you need to buy new pens and pencils? There is a stationery sale in the High Street.
Yes, I do need some new pens. How much are the sale items?
The sign says that everything is one-third of the original price. I've already bought a pen reduced from £6 to £2.
What a bargain!
Do you need to buy new pens and pencils? There is a stationery sale in the High Street.
Yes, I do need some new pens. How much are the sale items?
The sign says that everything is one-third of the original price. I've already bought a pen reduced from £6 to £2.
What a bargain!
Question 5. Where and when will the orchestra appear on television?
Don't forget that at the weekend, it's the International Youth Music Competition. Make sure your uniforms are washed, clean and tidy, and that your instruments are polished ready to tune, as we have to meet here at college by 7 a.m. Our orchestra is first on stage in the competition at 9 o'clock, but your parents can watch you later on Channel 20 at 10:30. Don't forget that at the weekend, it's the International Youth Music Competition. Make sure your uniforms are washed, clean and tidy, and that your instruments are polished ready to tune, as we have to meet here at college by 7 a.m. Our orchestra is first on stage in the competition at 9 o'clock, but your parents can watch you later on Channel 20 at 10:30.
Question 6. After the steps, what are the directions to the waterfall? Give 2 details.
Excuse me. We are trying to find our way to the waterfall. Is it anywhere near here, please?
Yes, but it's far below you. Go along this winding path and then down the steps ahead of you, leading into the valley. Watch out, because they're often muddy and slippery.
Ooh.
Walk along beside the river in the valley, and as you go round the bend, you'll see the waterfall, but you'll hear it first.
Oh. Excuse me. We are trying to find our way to the waterfall. Is it anywhere near here, please?
Yes, but it's far below you. Go along this winding path and then down the steps ahead of you, leading into the valley. Watch out, because they're often muddy and slippery.
Ooh.
Walk along beside the river in the valley, and as you go round the bend, you'll see the waterfall, but you'll hear it first.
Oh.
That is the last of questions 1 to 6. In a moment, you will hear question 7. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 7. Listen to the following interview about a mobile banking service for rural communities, and then complete the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Hello, and welcome to Country Matters. Today we are joined by a bank employee who carries out a great and necessary service for those who live in remote and rural areas. She brings a bank to their doorstep, a bank on wheels. Isn't that correct, Katrina?
Yes, indeed. I've driven the mobile bank every day from 9 to 5, except for weekends and bank holidays, for the 3 years since the service started. This is my job, and I love it. It's varied and interesting, and no 2 days are ever the same, so I can't get bored.
It must be lovely to be out in the open air and to be able to see different landscapes each day.
Yes, the scenery in my mobile area is stunning. My driving routes are mainly coastal, so each day I'm treated to sea breezes, I hear seagulls call, and I can choose whether to stop to eat my lunch on top of a cliff, under a shady row of trees, or by the beach.
Wonderful. We would all like to have your job. You must cover a huge distance in your van.
Yes, about 500 kilometres each week. I usually have the help of a colleague. She helps me with the actual banking, but I do most of the driving from place to place.
There must be lots more advantages to your job.
Oh, yes. You see, we have a sort of planned route whereby we make 13 scheduled stops each week, always in the same place. At a crossroads, perhaps, by the village shop, or in a seafront car park. This provides a much-needed service to people, almost a lifeline for them. Without us, these customers would have to travel miles to their nearest bank at great expense to them.
Your customers must really appreciate you. Do they mark your visits on their calendars?
They do. And in return, of course, we get to know them all personally and are able to take an interest in their lives. Often we're the first people a customer has spoken to for a few days. Our unique job is very important for our rural customers socially, as well as for business. Luckily, our bank recognises and encourages our caring sort of role here.
Do customers ever just come to talk to you, even if they don't need to carry out any banking business?
Yes, they often look into the van to greet us, even if they have no need of our banking services.
You really do provide a very good service to the communities you visit.
Yes. For example, our customers can pay bills, draw out cash, arrange for insurance, and collect money in other currencies if they need this for overseas travel.
Do you do request stops?
Oh, yes. In the summer, we often stop our van in tourist car parks where customers wave at us to stop. The holiday makers often photograph us because they have never seen a mobile bank before.
Yes, they're used to mobile grocers and mobile libraries, perhaps, but not banks.
I love being in the van. Usually, of course, I would be trapped in a bank office all day. I'm constantly aware of this and try always to provide service with a grateful smile.
Are there some days in winter when you can't go out in the van?
We experience ice on the roads and strong winds in winter here, so I often have to hang on to the steering wheel tightly. But generally, we manage to go out every day. Hot summer days are the most difficult for us. The van gets very hot very quickly. Whatever the weather, though, our regular customers are still waiting for us, and this really encourages us. We run a vital service, and they appreciate it.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Hello, and welcome to Country Matters. Today we are joined by a bank employee who carries out a great and necessary service for those who live in remote and rural areas. She brings a bank to their doorstep, a bank on wheels. Isn't that correct, Katrina?
Yes, indeed. I've driven the mobile bank every day from 9 to 5, except for weekends and bank holidays, for the 3 years since the service started. This is my job, and I love it. It's varied and interesting, and no 2 days are ever the same, so I can't get bored.
It must be lovely to be out in the open air and to be able to see different landscapes each day.
Yes. The scenery in my mobile area is stunning. My driving routes are mainly coastal, so each day I'm treated to sea breezes, I hear seagulls call, and I can choose whether to stop to eat my lunch on top of a cliff, under a shady row of trees, or by the beach.
Wonderful. We would all like to have your job. You must cover a huge distance in your van.
Yes, about 500 kilometres each week. I usually have the help of a colleague. She helps me with the actual banking, but I do most of the driving from place to place.
There must be lots more advantages to your job.
Oh, yes. You see, we have a sort of planned route whereby we make 13 scheduled stops each week, always in the same place, at a crossroads perhaps, by the village shop, or in a seafront car park. This provides a much-needed service to people, almost a lifeline for them. Without us, these customers would have to travel miles to their nearest bank at great expense to them.
Your customers must really appreciate you. Do they mark your visits on their calendars?
They do. And in return, of course, we get to know them all personally and are able to take an interest in their lives. Often we're the first people a customer has spoken to for a few days. Our unique job is very important for our rural customers socially, as well as for business. Luckily, our bank recognises and encourages our caring sort of role here.
Do customers ever just come to talk to you, even if they don't need to carry out any banking business?
Yes, they often look into the van to greet us, even if they have no need of our banking services.
You really do provide a very good service to the communities you visit.
Yes. For example, our customers can pay bills, draw out cash, arrange for insurance, and collect money in other currencies if they need this for overseas travel.
Do you do request stops?
Oh, yes. In the summer, we often stop our van in tourist car parks where customers wave at us to stop. The holiday makers often photograph us because they have never seen a mobile bank before.
Yes, they're used to mobile grocers and mobile libraries, perhaps, but not banks.
I love being in the van. Usually, of course, I would be trapped in a bank office all day. I'm constantly aware of this and try always to provide service with a grateful smile.
Are there some days in winter when you can't go out in the van?
We experience ice on the roads and strong winds in winter here, so I often have to hang on to the steering wheel tightly. But generally, we manage to go out every day. Hot summer days are the most difficult for us. The van gets very hot very quickly. Whatever the weather, though, our regular customers are still waiting for us, and this really encourages us. We run a vital service, and they appreciate it.
That is the end of question 7. In a moment, you will hear question 8. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8. Listen to the following interview about a prize-winning toy, and then complete the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
In our computerized, digital, text messaging world, we have refreshing news today. Following worldwide research, it's been revealed that our favorite children's toy is not electronic. The winner is the humble plastic building brick. You probably have some in your house. Those little bricks which fit together to make models. Today's result is the same as 50 years ago in 1960. Here is a project leader from the Danish manufacturer of these bricks to tell us more.
Thank you. We are very pleased with the results of this extensive research. We are delighted to confirm that our bricks remain as popular today as they have done since they were first launched.
When was that?
We began by making wooden building bricks. That was in 1934. Then we turned to making plastic bricks, which would fit together to make models, in 1949. By 1963, we had perfected this.
You must have made a lot of bricks since then.
We make 20 million little plastic bricks each year. Statisticians tell us we have made enough bricks for everyone in the world to own 60 of them.
Well, I don't own any. Someone else must have my 60 brick quota.
Of course, some families probably own 6,000 of our bricks, or even 60,000 perhaps, if they have been collecting them for a long time.
Do you still make the bricks on your original factory site?
Yes. Our production has always been from the same original place. My family built the factory on our lands all that time ago. We have kept the company within our own family. My great-grandfather, my grandfather, my father, myself, and now my son have all taken part over the years.
How have you kept your product so popular when there are so many new items competing for children's interest? Games, computers, robots?
We produce catalogues, newsletters, a free children's magazine with up-to-date news of new models, and we have even opened theme parks. We also rely very much on customer satisfaction and hope they will recommend our products to their friends.
What other reasons are there for your continuing popularity?
We try to link new sets of bricks with the themes of popular films. Many parents buy these packs for their children as they think it encourages imaginative role play, which it does, of course. Children love reenacting scenarios with our little superhero plastic models.
But you have always produced those lovely, plain, brightly coloured bricks too, haven't you?
Of course. These encourage generation after generation of children to think, play, and create things for themselves. Even our logo, when translated into English, means play well.
Are your bricks only for children, or do adult builders buy them too?
Actually, there are many adult enthusiasts around the world. They build ambitious models, then meet for conferences and display their designs. Often they have made their garage, attic space or garden shed into a design studio. Some of our products are very sophisticated. For example, our animation and our robotic packages. And these appeal especially to the adult market.
A famous architect once said that architecture began when two bricks were put together. And you certainly have helped many generations to do that. I hope your success will last for many future generations too.
Now you will hear the interview again.
In our computerized, digital, text messaging world, we have refreshing news today. Following worldwide research, it's been revealed that our favorite children's toy is not electronic. The winner is the humble plastic building brick. You probably have some in your house. Those little bricks which fit together to make models. Today's result is the same as 50 years ago in 1960. Here is a project leader from the Danish manufacturer of these bricks to tell us more.
Thank you. We are very pleased with the results of this extensive research. We are delighted to confirm that our bricks remain as popular today as they have done since they were first launched.
When was that?
We began by making wooden building bricks. That was in 1934. Then we turned to making plastic bricks, which would fit together to make models, in 1949. By 1963, we had perfected this.
You must have made a lot of bricks since then.
We make 20 million little plastic bricks each year. Statisticians tell us we have made enough bricks for everyone in the world to own 60 of them.
Well, I don't own any. Someone else must have my 60 brick quota.
Of course, some families probably own 6,000 of our bricks, or even 60,000 perhaps, if they have been collecting them for a long time.
Do you still make the bricks on your original factory site?
Yes. Our production has always been from the same original place. My family built the factory on our lands all that time ago. We have kept the company within our own family. My great-grandfather, my grandfather, my father, myself, and now my son have all taken part over the years.
How have you kept your product so popular when there are so many new items competing for children's interest? Games, computers, robots?
We produce catalogues, newsletters, a free children's magazine with up-to-date news of new models, and we have even opened theme parks. We also rely very much on customer satisfaction and hope they will recommend our products to their friends.
What other reasons are there for your continuing popularity?
We try to link new sets of bricks with the themes of popular films. Many parents buy these packs for their children as they think it encourages imaginative role play, which it does, of course. Children love reenacting scenarios with our little superhero plastic models.
But you have always produced those lovely, plain, brightly coloured bricks too, haven't you?
Of course. These encourage generation after generation of children to think, play, and create things for themselves. Even our logo, when translated into English, means play well.
Are your bricks only for children, or do adult builders buy them too?
Actually, there are many adult enthusiasts around the world. They build ambitious models, then meet for conferences and display their designs. Often they have made their garage, attic space or garden shed into a design studio. Some of our products are very sophisticated. For example, our animation and our robotic packages. And these appeal especially to the adult market.
A famous architect once said that architecture began when two bricks were put together. And you certainly have helped many generations to do that. I hope your success will last for many future generations too.
That is the end of question 8. In a moment you will hear question 9. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam.
You'll hear part of a radio interview with a swimming instructor. For questions 9 to 18, complete the sentences. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part 2.
And now for our sports section. And I have with me today Paul Collison, who is a swimming instructor, with a rather unusual approach. Thanks for taking the time during your holiday to come and talk to us, Paul.
It's very kind of you to invite me.
Paul, you're the swimming instructor at the Palace Hotel in the south of France. How long have you been there?
Oh, well, I started working there in 1970 when I was 18 years old.
And you've never moved?
Nope. I get to meet a lot of famous people there and I guess I enjoy that.
And, of course, a lot of them go there because they want you to teach them to swim.
Well, that's true, but I teach plenty of other people too, and not all my students are beginners.
But we're not talking about young children, are we?
Not usually. There isn't the same challenge teaching children. They have an almost a natural ability to swim. Adults are afraid, and helping them overcome that is hard, but much more fun somehow.
But don't a lot of people just give up trying to learn once they reach a certain age?
Not at all. I get hundreds of calls from people looking for sympathetic instructors. I would estimate that about 50% of the adult population can't swim, but they're still keen to learn.
So it's just fear that holds them back?
Basically, yes. I come across it all the time, and it isn't just beginners. I have students who can swim a bit, but don't make any progress because, well, like all of them, they hate going underwater.
Mm. So, what's the secret, Paul?
Well, you've got to relax in the water, and that means that you must control your breathing.
And I understand you have a special technique to help people do that.
Yes. Before my students even go into the pool, I teach them how to breathe. And to do that, I give everyone a salad bowl.
A salad bowl? Right.
Everyone in the group gets one of these, each full of water. First, I get them to breathe slowly through the nose and mouth, mm-hmm. just normal controlled breathing.
To calm them.
Uh-huh. And then they all have to put their faces in the bowl and breathe out underwater.
How does it go?
Well, they're all terrified at first, so we repeat the exercise many times, and in the end they become quite competitive about who can keep their face down the longest.
And that means they've started to forget about their fear.
Exactly. When I'm sure they're more confident about breathing, I move the group into the pool and I tell them that they're going to begin by trying to float with their faces in the water. Once I'm sure they're okay, I start them off and I teach different swimming strokes to different pupils, depending on which one I think they'll find easiest. The swimming technique itself is far less important than feeling confident in the water.
Great. So how many lessons would I need to learn to swim?
Well, all my lessons are an hour long, and generally it just takes three to overcome the fear and get people swimming. A few never make it, but I'd say 90% end up swimmers.
So there's hope for us all yet. And now on to Michelle.
Now you'll hear part two again.
And now for our sports section. And I have with me today Paul Collison, who is a swimming instructor, with a rather unusual approach. Thanks for taking the time during your holiday to come and talk to us, Paul.
It's very kind of you to invite me.
Paul, you're the swimming instructor at the Palace Hotel in the south of France. How long have you been there?
Oh, well, I started working there in 1970 when I was 18 years old.
And you've never moved?
Nope. I get to meet a lot of famous people there, and I guess I enjoy that.
And, of course, a lot of them go there because they want you to teach them to swim.
Well, that's true, but I teach plenty of other people too, and not all my students are beginners.
But we're not talking about young children, are we?
Not usually. There isn't the same challenge teaching children. They have an almost a natural ability to swim. Adults are afraid, and helping them overcome that is hard, but much more fun somehow.
But don't a lot of people just give up trying to learn once they reach a certain age?
Not at all. I get hundreds of calls from people looking for sympathetic instructors. I would estimate that about 50% of the adult population can't swim, but they're still keen to learn.
So it's just fear that holds them back?
Basically, yes. I come across it all the time. And it isn't just beginners. I have students who can swim a bit, but don't make any progress because, well, like all of them, they hate going underwater.
Mm. So what's the secret, Paul?
Well, you've got to relax in the water, and that means that you must control your breathing.
And I understand you have a special technique to help people do that.
Yes. Before my students even go into the pool, I teach them how to breathe. And to do that, I give everyone a salad bowl.
A salad bowl? Right.
Everyone in the group gets one of these, each full of water. First, I get them to breathe slowly through the nose and mouth, mm-hmm. just normal controlled breathing.
To calm them.
Uh-huh. And then they all have to put their faces in the bowl and breathe out underwater.
How does it go?
Well, they're all terrified at first, so we repeat the exercise many times, and in the end they become quite competitive about who can keep their face down the longest.
And that means they've started to forget about their fear.
Exactly. When I'm sure they're more confident about breathing, I move the group into the pool, and I tell them that they're going to begin by trying to float with their faces in the water. Once I'm sure they're okay, I start them off, and I teach different swimming strokes to different pupils, depending on which one I think they'll find easiest. The swimming technique itself is far less important than feeling confident in the water.
Great. So how many lessons would I need to learn to swim?
Well, all my lessons are an hour long, and generally it just takes three to overcome the fear and get people swimming. A few never make it, but I'd say 90% end up swimmers.
So there's hope for us all yet. And now on to Michelle.
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You'll hear part of a radio programme called Morning Market. Five listeners have telephoned the programme because they have something to sell. For questions 19 to 23, choose which of the statements, A to F, matches the reason each of the people gives for selling their possession. Use the letters only once. There's one extra letter which you do not need to use. You now have 30 seconds in which to look at part three. Speaker 1.
I've got a brand new rowing machine. I won it, actually, about 2 months ago, and it's still in its box. It's got an electric timer on it, which tells you how much rowing you've done and all that. So anyone who's into exercise can do lots of rowing and keep fit and healthy. It folds up really small, so, you know, it won't take up too much space in, like, a bedroom or anything. I mean, I'll never use it, because I was after the holiday, which was won by whoever came first in the competition. So I'm looking for around £45. And my number is 773...
Speaker 2.
I've got a kidney-shaped bath, a colour soft cream, for sale. It's still in its original packing case, because I ordered the wrong colour. You know, it didn't go with the rest of the bathroom suite I'd got. So I contacted, you know, the suppliers, who said they'll send me a replacement. At a price, of course. But I've now got to get rid of this one. It cost originally £175, and I'm letting it go for £50, if anyone's interested. OK, my number's 01723.
Speaker 3.
I've got a real bargain. It's a Lieberstein electric organ, and it's got two keyboards and a rhythm section. It's in good condition, plays quite well, and it's not difficult to use or anything. But what with us having a baby on the way, it's got to make way for more essential items, as we've only got a tiny flat at the moment. So, as I say, if anyone wants it, they can make me an offer. The only problem is anyone interested would have to come and collect it. The number to ring is 672...
Speaker 4.
Hello. I've got a lady's cycle for sale. I've got back trouble, and I've been advised not to ride it. So rather than be tempted, I'll get rid of it. I hate the idea, because we're not well served with public transport out here, and I used it quite a lot. But as I daren't ride it any more, I think it would be a mistake to hang on to it. You know, in case I had second thoughts. So, it's a rally chopper, pink, and I'd like £35 for it, please. I can be contacted on 0181.
Speaker 5.
I've got two frying pans, you know, the sort for cooking stir-frying, and a 7-piece tool set to go with them. All boxed and everything. Anyway, they've hardly been used, because at one time I was intending to do a lot of this type of cooking, because I've only got a small kitchenette, like, no oven. But I've been given a microwave instead now. It's so much easier to use. So that's £10 for both pans and the tools, and my number is 01745.
Now you'll hear part three again. Speaker 1.
I've got a brand new rowing machine. I won it, actually, about 2 months ago, and it's still in its box. It's got an electric timer on it, which tells you how much rowing you've done and all that, so anyone who's into exercise can do lots of rowing and keep fit and healthy. It folds up really small, so, you know, it won't take up too much space in, like, a bedroom or anything. I mean, I'll never use it, because I was after the holiday, which was won by whoever came first in the competition. So I'm looking for around £45. My number is 773...
Speaker 2.
I've got a kidney-shaped bath, a colour soft cream, for sale. It's still in its original packing case, because I ordered the wrong colour. You know, it didn't go with the rest of the bathroom suite I'd got. So I contacted, you know, the suppliers, who said they'll send me a replacement. At a price, of course. But I've now got to get rid of this one. It cost originally £175, and I'm letting it go for £50, if anyone's interested. OK, my number's 01723.
Speaker 3.
I've got a real bargain. It's a Lieberstein electric organ, and it's got two keyboards and a rhythm section. It's in good condition, plays quite well, and it's not difficult to use or anything. But what with us having a baby on the way, it's got to make way for more essential items, as we've only got a tiny flat at the moment. So, as I say, if anyone wants it, they can make me an offer. The only problem is anyone interested would have to come and collect it. The number to ring is 672-44...
Speaker 4.
Hello. I've got a lady's cycle for sale. I've got back trouble, and I've been advised not to ride it. So rather than be tempted, I'll get rid of it. I hate the idea, because we're not well served with public transport out here, and I used it quite a lot. But as I daren't ride it any more, I think it would be a mistake to hang on to it. You know, in case I had second thoughts. So, it's a rally chopper, pink, and I'd like £35 for it, please. I can be contacted on 0181...
Speaker 5.
I've got two frying pans, you know, the sort for cooking stir-frying, and a 7-piece tool set to go with them. All boxed and everything. Anyway, they've hardly been used, because at one time I was intending to do a lot of this type of cooking, because I've only got a small kitchenette, like, no oven. But I've been given a microwave instead now. It's so much easier to use. So that's £10 for both pans and the tools, and my number is 01745.
That's the end of part three. Now turn to part four. You'll hear an interview with a man who makes models for films and television. For questions 24 to 30, choose the best answer A, B or C. You now have 1 minute in which to look at part four.
Matt Ryan makes models. He's worked for television and various other companies for many years. I went to his studio in London to talk to him. Matt, could I ask you to tell listeners a bit about your background and your early career?
Sure. Well, it's strange, really, because at first I never thought about model making as a career. Fairly early on in my life, I worked for a television channel. I really wanted a full-time job there, but the best I could get was holiday relief work, filling in for people while they were away. Mm. I started off in the photograph library, and we had to collect pictures for the news, and it was a good way of getting into the business.
So how did the career come about?
I think it was an interesting time altogether, really. It was the 60s, and everyone was talking about going to the moon. There were comic books about space and models of astronauts. Where I was working, we had photographs which were used in television reports on the subject. The scenes fascinated me, and I thought, why not build some three-dimensional kits or models of the views instead of these flat photos that were mostly black and white?
Mm. And what happened to them?
Something quite incredible, really. I still think back on it with a lot of pride. During one of the space trips to the moon, the camera on the spacecraft burnt out, and we had no pictures back in the television studio to put on the news. So they used a total of 15 of my models as a substitute, and they were broadcast to everyone at home.
Do you think that marked the beginning of a career with television?
Yes, because shortly after that, I was asked to go to a meeting with one of the TV heads. It was a time when they were looking for more people. And I think nowadays that type of thing wouldn't happen. You'd need 2 degrees and about 6 years' experience. But they put me straight onto one of the biggest TV series at the time.
What was that?
It was called Bright Star, and it was a children's programme they produced about a time traveller. You know the kind of thing. Each week he had a different adventure in the 21st century, and each time there would be monsters or strange creatures that he'd have to deal with. And I made most of the models for these. And I was just one of a whole load of people. You'd need makeup artists and scene makers and costume designers. It was incredible.
Mm. Can we move on to some other programmes that you've worked on? Because they haven't all been science fiction, have they?
No. In fact, the afternoon children's programmes were very demanding too. I made a regular appearance on these where I might talk about how to make your own toys or create your own set for a story or run a competition based on space research.
And you were also involved in documentaries at the time, weren't you?
Yes. To be honest, I did so many of them that I've lost count. But my favourite was Heart of Darkness, for which I won television prizes. That was quite funny because at the time it wasn't possible to get an award for what I did. You know, you could be best actor or best director, but there was no category for special effects. Well, only in films, not television. So they put my name forward for a lot of other things, and I actually won 7 of them.
Matt, thank you for a fascinating interview.
Now you'll hear part 4 again.
Matt Ryan makes models. He's worked for television and various other companies for many years. I went to his studio in London to talk to him. Matt, could I ask you to tell listeners a bit about your background and your early career?
Sure. Well, it's strange, really, because at first I never thought about model making as a career. Fairly early on in my life, I worked for a television channel. I really wanted a full-time job there, but the best I could get was holiday relief work, filling in for people while they were away. I started off in the photograph library, and we had to collect pictures for the news, and it was a good way of getting into the business.
So how did the career come about?
I think it was an interesting time altogether, really. It was the 60s, and everyone was talking about going to the moon. There were comic books about space and models of astronauts. Where I was working, we had photographs which were used in television reports on the subject. The scenes fascinated me, and I thought, why not build some three-dimensional kits or models of the views instead of these flat photos that were mostly black and white?
And what happened to them?
Something quite incredible, really. I still think back on it with a lot of pride. During one of the space trips to the moon, the camera on the spacecraft burnt out, and we had no pictures back in the television studio to put on the news. So they used a total of 15 of my models as a substitute, and they were broadcast to everyone at home.
Do you think that marked the beginning of a career with television?
Yes, because shortly after that, I was asked to go to a meeting with one of the TV heads. It was a time when they were looking for more people. And I think nowadays that type of thing wouldn't happen. You'd need 2 degrees and about 6 years' experience. But they put me straight onto one of the biggest TV series at the time.
What was that?
It was called Bright Star, and it was a children's programme they produced about a time traveller. You know the kind of thing. Each week he had a different adventure in the 21st century, and each time there would be monsters or strange creatures that he'd have to deal with. And I made most of the models for these. And I was just one of a whole load of people. You'd need makeup artists and scene makers and costume designers. It was incredible.
Can we move on to some other programmes that you've worked on? Because they haven't all been science fiction, have they?
No. In fact, the afternoon children's programmes were very demanding too. I made a regular appearance on these, where I might talk about how to make your own toys or create your own set for a story or run a competition based on space research.
And you were also involved in documentaries at the time, weren't you?
Yes. To be honest, I did so many of them that I've lost count. But my favourite was Heart of Darkness, for which I won television prizes. That was quite funny because at the time it wasn't possible to get an award for what I did. You know, you could be best actor or best director, but there was no category for special effects. Well, only in films, not television. So they put my name forward for a lot of other things, and I actually won 7 of them.
Matt, thank you for a fascinating interview.
That's the end of part 4. There'll now be a pause of 5 minutes for you to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. Be sure to follow the numbering of all the questions. I'll remind you when there is 1 minute left so that you're sure to finish in time. That's the end of the test. Please stop now. Your supervisor will now collect all the question papers and answer sheets.